and the daylight.
Yeah, so thank you very much for having me here. So today I'm going to try to give you in 20 minutes a little tour about what are the observational evidence for enhanced mass loss and episodic mass loss in massive stars. So let me just start by giving you a little bit of background. So we can actually say that we have evidence for this enhanced mass loss pretty much in every possible class of supernovae. And that goes from hydrogen-stripped supernovae to hydrogen-rich supernovae. And actually, this mass loss from massive stars actually helped us finding a connection between these two worlds that were thought to be completely disjoint up until a few years ago. So what are the tools that we use? What are the basic things that we can use on the observational side? And here I had to choose the main three tools that are out there that we have been using. But please don't get too upset with me. I know there are many others that you can use. And if you're interested, just go there and see. So the first thing that we can do, of course, is to sit there and see what the stars are doing before collapsing. And this is something that we can do right now. We were not able to do it before, just because before we were relying on amateur astronomers, which are extremely good people, but they're human, so they tend to find things when they're bright. So basically, we were missing out on the pre-supernova evolution of these massive stars. Right now, thanks to the surveys, we are able to monitor the night sky every single night, so we can actually see the outbursts of stars just before the main explosion. And so which of these showed evidence, for which of these causes we do have evidence for outbursts before core collapse? So we do have evidence for outbursts in type 2N supernovae, which are this kind of supernovae that shows hydrogen and narrow features in their spectra. We also have evidence for outbursts in type 1BN supernovae, which came up yesterday, actually. Those are type 1, so hydrogen poor, B means yes, helium, and N, narrow helium. So here we have evidence for outbursts, but the material the shock is interacting with is helium rich. And I find it very interesting to say that even if statistically speaking is a little bit less significant, there is possibly an evidence for an eruption in a progenitor of a type 1BC supernova as well. Here we go, and it's not changing, okay. So the other way we are using to learn about the mass loss of stars just before collapse is by using what is now known as flash spectroscopy. It's a tool that PTF has been pioneering so far. So what's the concept here? It's very simple. So at the time of core collapse, you have a burst of radiation, and this radiation is going to ionize the medium very close to the explosion. So this kind of thing is going to give you information about whatever is sitting very, very, very close to the star, which means that was ejected very, very close to the time of core collapse. And there has been a paper a few weeks ago about the use of this tool for a type 2P supernovae. So why is that so cool? Because type 2P supernovae are the most common core collapse supernovae around. So here the message seems that even the most common progenitors of core collapse supernovae tend to have this evidence for enhanced mass loss. So it's something that seems to be common. And for those kind of supernovae, you're going to hear later during this conference, we do also have evidence for progenitors, which are red supergiants. This kind of tool has been used for type 2P supernovae, but always from PTF, we had also a very nice work where the same thing has been used to investigate the very nearby environment of type 1BC supernovae as well. So even in that case, totally different progenitor, but still the same tool told us that yes, you do have enhanced mass loss even in that case. Then let's investigate the third way we have to learn about massive star, and this is using the supernova shock as a probe of the environment. It's very, very simple again. The idea is that we have our star. Before explosion, the star is releasing a lot of material into the environment. So at the time of my explosion, what happens is that the shock is going to go through this environment, and it's going to accelerate particles electrons, and this is the source of a lot of radio and X-ray emission. So the idea is that if my star was not well behaved and produced a very complex environment, I should be able to learn about this very complex environment, because this thing is going to leave very peculiar imprints on my X-ray and radio observations. So what is really cool about this shock interaction? So here's what I think is the beauty of this. So the shock velocity is way larger than the typical ejection velocity of material before the star death. So this means that the shock from my supernova is catching up with material very fast. So that every time T of my investigation, every time T of my monitoring after core collapse, I'm actually seeing what the star was doing at a time which is V shock over V ejecta time T. So I can actually go back. It actually works as a time machine. And the shock interaction with the medium has been used in any kind of supernova to investigate the properties of the medium around. And here today, I just want to draw your attention to two particular cases which lie in the world of hydrogen strip supernovae. So type 1 BCs, I'm going to get back to them later, and type 2B supernovae. So type 2B supernovae are the cases where the stars arrive at the time of our collapse with a little thin shell of hydrogen. So they are called type 2 because we do see hydrogen at the beginning, but this hydrogen goes away quickly and it disappears. So there are a number of things that I could say, but today I just want to really focus your attention on a result, which I believe is very important, but maybe is not as well known. So what we have been finding is that the radio from the radio observations at late times, what we have been finding is that the radio observations at late times speak directly to the optical at very early times. It is all in this plot, and I'm sure you're still confused, but now I'm going to translate the axis in a different way. So the epoch that of the peak of radio emission is telling you how much material is in the environment. On the y-axis, instead, you have a measurement of how much energy was emitted in the UV bright peak at the very beginning. And this is a way to measure how extended was the progenitor. So what is the message here? So the message that we are finding is that radio observations at late times know about the progenitor structure at the time of collapse. So I don't know anything about my progenitor, but I find a lot of material in the environment, this is enough for me to know that the progenitor was actually extended or not extended. So in other words, we are finding clear evidence that mass loss that we find around type 2B progenitors speaks very, very nicely to the progenitor structure at the time of collapse. All right, so let's go back to this plot, and let's put all our tools together. So I told you that with flash spectroscopy, we can investigate the environment very close to the massive star, so let's say 10 to the 15 centimeters. And with direct imaging of the at the location of a star, I can go back in time with direct observations of what the star is doing in the years before. By using the supernova shock as a probe, I can actually go even to earlier times, so I can see what the star is doing even before then. So you do understand that by putting everything together, we have now really the possibility to investigate this portion of stellar evolution that is still full of questions. And the idea and the dream would be to connect what we find in this range to what is going on inside the star, and maybe find some connections there. So we have this knowledge gap. We are trying to fill that in with observations across the spectrum. That's the basic idea. So let's go back to this plot. And the one thing that I want you to take home is that you can clearly see that basically we have here a whole range of stellar progenitors, a whole range of supernova types, and all of these stars are producing enhanced mass loss before stellar explosion. That's the message that we are getting from the universe. All right. So there are a lot of things that I could be speaking about today, but I only have 20 minutes, so I will have to focus. And I selected two particular explosions to try and see what these two explosions, so 9AP and 14C, were able to tell us about mass loss in general. So let me just start with the story of 9AP, and then I'll transition to 14C. So we start first from the world of hydrogen-rich supernovae, and then we go to hydrogen-stripped. So O9IP was discovered in 2009, and it was named supernova O9IP, but it was not actually a supernova in 2009. The same star underwent a number of eruptions before a major couple of major explosions in 2012. And here is a zoom in with real data about what happened in 2012. And you can clearly see the number of eruptions of this star before 2012. This is a star, and this is just to give you an idea of how much energy is there. So there has been a crazy campaign to go after this particular explosion all over the spectrum, from gamma rays to the radio. And again, today I don't have the time to tell you the details, but I want you to focus on two observational properties that I think are very, very important. So the first is that what we saw in the case of a 9AP is actually not something that is particular to this star, but actually other stars produce something very, very similar. And here you have an example of 10MC. It's not rescaled, it's just how they look like. So they're extremely similar. And I can tell you that there are others, the other explosions that look very similar. So what is the message here? So you have two explosions, totally independent, that they show, and they show something very similar. It means that whatever is causing this phenomenology must be in some way simple, because otherwise it would be very, very difficult just by chance to end up with the same set of parameters. The other thing that I want you to draw your attention to is that if you do a temporal analysis of the outburst before the major explosion, you will find that the system showed a preferred time scale. It's not a claim for periodicity, not at all, but it's a preferred time scale, which is around 40 days. So this is particular to O9AP. We did the same job on other explosions, and you will find that again, this 40 days time scale, let's say 20 to 50, come up. So there must be something, some physics that decides that this is a preferred time scale for these systems. So for O9AP, we were actually a little lucky, and we also had pre-explosion imaging at location in the sky. So we knew that the star producing this very complex display is this one. And if you do some numbers, you would infer a very massive progenitor for O9AP, which is good and bad, because a lot of people then said, well, at the end of the day, maybe this is something that only happens to very massive stars, and those are just a little tiny portion of all the stars that you have, so why should I care? So in the next 7 minutes, I will try to convince you that this kind of ejections, this kind of episodic mass loss actually does not happen only in these very massive progenitors, but is something more common than this. And I'll try to tell you the story of this other supernova, supernova 2014C. So this is one of the cases that showed that we can actually, a supernova can be born as a type 1 supernova, but over time it can actually transition into a totally different type. So we can go across the classification scheme of supernovae. So what is, let's have a closer look to this supernova. And I'll start with optical, then I'll go through radio, then x-rays, then we put everything together, we understand what's going on. So at the very beginning, and here I really don't care about the details here, but at the very beginning, this supernova, both spectroscopically and photometrically, it looked like branch normal. Nothing stands out. The beginning is a normal type 1b. No hydrogen, B, yes, helium. Period. However, we have been persistent, and we kept monitoring, and you can clearly see that this supernova developed hydrogen, broad hydrogen features, which is something that you do not usually see in a type 1b supernova. Well, so while that was happening in the optical, let's see what happened in the radio. So here you have radio luminosity versus time, and here is 14C. There is actually another data point right here, right now. So you can see that we have this case of an increasing radioluminosity at late times. Again, this is something that is not super common in type 1b supernovae. So let's have a look at the same situation in the x-rays. Same exercise. We monitored 14C, and we found a rising x-ray luminosity with time, which is also unusual. So the other piece that was very unusual was that not only the x-rays were rising, but the spectrum was also very hard, which motivated the new story pointing. So what you're looking at here is the first image of an extragalactic type 1 supernovae in hard x-rays. So let's put everything together. So basically, you have a supernova that was born very, very normal. And if I manage to click the right one, yeah. And then with time, build up hydrogen. So it was started as a type 1 and then became a type 2. And while doing that, the x-rays went up and the radio kept increasing. So how can we explain this? Well, I'm sure you're already understanding what's going on here. What happened is that we had our supernova that started to interact with a very typical hydrogen-poor medium, but at some point the shocks crashed against a wall of the hydrogen, and this is what caused the transition from type 1 to type 2. We were actually able to do a nice follow-up from radio to the x-rays, which allowed us to understand the properties of the medium. So we were really able to put some numbers on this very, very, very basic idea. And we were able to understand that the hydrogen-rich material was sitting very close to the star, something a few 10 to the 16 centimeters, and that there was quite a lot of material here, one solar mass plus minus factor of a few. So now we have this, we are left with this problem to explain why, instead of having something like this, we have something like that. So why is that? What's going on here? And one possibility while working with Selma and Manos was, well, maybe we were not alone. We did not die alone. We had a companion that helped us shedding some of the hydrogen envelopes, so binary evolution. Another possibility, and you understand that these binaries are the ones that are responsible to help us shedding our hydrogen, this does not naturally explain why this is happening close to core collapse. It just happened to have happened, but not is not natural. Another possibility is that maybe this hydrogen envelope was ejected because of some nuclear instabilities that we were not aware, or maybe we were not considering so far. And in this case, you understand that this mechanism knows that the star is approaching stellar death. So in this case, the ejection of the envelope and the stellar death are timed by construction, I would say. And another possibility that we have heard yesterday a lot about is that maybe internal gravity waves are helping us putting the energy at the base of the envelope. So I have to tell you that with only one, based on only 14C, there is no way we can tell what is what. However, we believe there is a way out, and the way out is to do statistics, to understand how many of these type 1 BC progenitors do something like this, when they do it, how much mass they eject. And what we did in our preliminary study was to go back to all the radio observations of supernovae, type 1 BCs. Why radio? Because that's a wavelength range where we have the most homogeneous data set right now. And try and see in how many cases we do have evidence for radio rebrightening, so late times. And we found other four cases when that happened, which gives us this percentage of roughly 10% of type 1 BCs progenitors do something that is similar on this time scale. So why that was interesting? Because, as I said, you would expect, if binaries are the ones responsible for this, you would expect not every single massive star to do it, but only a few of them, so just by chance. And here is a plot that I'm going to skip in the interest of time, but if you have questions, just ask me about. So here is my summary plot, the takeaway message. So what I'm plotting here is the amount of mass that was ejected as a function of time before collapse. So we do know for a fact that we do have in some cases, evidence for eruptions in the ears before collapse. And this is something that we saw in type 2Ns, type 1Bns, and for superluminal supernovae. I did not have the time to even speak about those, but I know that I think on Thursday, there's going to be a session dedicated to them. So for these cases, we do know that these progenitors must have ejected a lot of material before collapse, very close to the time of core collapse. And until now, we had this idea that all type 1BC core collapses, if they did eject things and in eruptions, well, that must have happened at much earlier times because we never had clear evidence for that. However, with 14C and the other four guys that I mentioned, we start now to populate this gap. So we do have evidence right now for stars that are filling up this gap. And actually, since I'm already out of time, I actually invite you to go and have a look at a poster that is sitting in the other room, where something similar, this hydrogen line, appeared also in superluminal supernovae type 1. And I'm done.
Questions, please?
I just want to make a comment. I think it's beautiful data, and there's a lot of things to learn from that. If you put up your last previous plot, so what is done not only by you but by most people is that the inferred distance of the material from the progenitor is translated into a time axis.
Yeah, yeah.
There is an assumption there, which I think should be made very, very explicit, namely that the material is flowing away from the star.
Yeah.
There's also models which predict that some material can be stationary sitting there mm-hmm. for eons and waiting for the star to die.
That's true. That's yeah. Yeah. Comment again.
Nathan?
Just to that point, Norbert, that's not an assumption, though. It's not an assumption. Whenever we get high enough resolution spectra of the supernova type 2N, we actually see P-Cygni profiles of the stuff that the shock is running into. It is outflowing. And we use the velocity that we observe to derive the time before the supernovas. Every case where we have high enough resolution spectra to see it, we see it. I don't know, but all the ones I've looked at, I got high resolution.
Yeah.
100% of the ones in my papers.
So, just to follow up on that question of whether this material is flowing at, you know, a few hundred kilometers per second, or whether it's a stationary. I think from the superluminal type 1, we do see some kind of spectral evidence that the you know, at least the hydrogen line have a few hundred kilometers per second offset, which I mean, of course, the interpretation that it can be, it's not definitive whether this material is stationary or it's moving, but I think in our current calculation, we actually say clearly that we're assuming that this is moving at a few hundred kilometers per second. But the question is, the physically, is it possible for this material just sits there and do nothing?
Well, just think of a bow shock. If you have a moving star, a bow shock will give you that.
I mean, many tensile mass material just sits there and...
There's models of that, and I'll talk about that on
okay.
Friday.
Oh, good. All right.
So what's the answer for 2014C? You showed some spectra, and there looked like those H-alpha lines or maybe 1,000 kilometers
a couple of thousand, yeah.
So is that a measure of the velocity before the supernova shock hit it or after?
And so the H-alpha profile shows a narrow component, which is the velocity of the material in front of you, and that is 100 kilometers per second, which is the wind in front of you. The broad component that you see is actually a measurement of the shocked H-alpha, so it's actually a measurement of how fast is your shock moving across the shell.
But you did have a narrow line
in
that event.
Absolutely,
okay,
yes.
Can I ask? So I think it's important to realize that having a velocity of only 100 kilometers a second is pretty unusual from the point of view of mass loss.
Yes.
And so what you have is a situation where you've ejected a boatload of mass loss at a very low speed. And that suggests a mechanism by whatever drove that was very well tuned to just basically get the material off the surface without hardly any kinetic energy.
Yes.
And
yes.
Almost all the energy went into lifting it from the surface into potential energy.
Yes.
And so that's a very interesting, and that puts a lot of constraints on what kind of dynamical model can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and another thing, if I may add, the other thing is that the mechanism must know to be very efficient in cleaning up the star of the hydrogen. That's the other very interesting thing.
More questions?
Yeah, just a quick one. Do you have any information on the metallicity of the region where 14C blew up?
Yeah, this is actually in the Danny Milosavljevic paper. It's not low metallicity. That's the answer, yeah. It's pretty normal. Yeah, exactly.
So really great work. In terms of the 1B1C sample you mentioned, I couldn't help but recognize that 3 out of 4 actually Brolin type 1Cs.
Yes.
And I think that's really interesting in terms of, you know, GRB connection and in the ways how you can get rid of the layers for these ones. I think this is becoming very interesting.
Yeah.
Are there any prospects in increasing the size?
Okay.
That's the sample size?
Yeah. So what I'm doing right now is really to try and build a controlled sample, because the problem with that other sample that I showed, the 4 out of 40-something supernova, the problem is that that sample is not complete, it's not controlled. So what I'm doing right now is do an H-alpha and radio survey altogether so that we can really pin down that percentage at the level of accuracy that we maybe we'll be able to answer if binaries are responsible or not. Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Rapelli Green, and we have our